Dr. Masaka. I have a PhD from the University of Michigan. And
what year did you get that?
1955.
Mm-hmm. Your first job after that was?
I went with my one of my thesis advisors, Gardner Ackley, was made chief economist for the Office of Price Stabilization during the Korean War. So I went to Washington with him and learned all about the problems of price control. You really have to be involved in it to understand how the price system works, you know. So that was great education.
Ackley was very involved with the wage and price guidelines when he was chairman, so I guess that experience stood him in
good stead. Yeah, he was the chief economist for price control during the Korean War.
So
we had, as it turned out, we had very good fiscal and monetary policy, and we didn't need price control.
Mm-hmm.
That's really the gist of it. Truman was didn't believe in financing wars the way Lyndon Johnson did, and so he raised taxes, and the Fed followed a tight policy, and it really wasn't. We found ourselves in a situation where, you know, we didn't have any inflationary pressures to deal with.
The Fed and the Treasury, though, perceived that there was a problem with inflation in 57, but by today's standards, it was not significant.
Yeah, well, this I'm talking about now was back in 52. But then I was still working on my dissertation, and part-time. And the only other employer, when they were closing down the Office of Price Stabilization, the only one hiring economists at that time was the CIA.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to work for them for a year and a half.
Hmm.
And I decided I had to get out of there. You know, I was involved in the... I was not a spy. I was an analyst.
Sure.
They had the covert and the overt side. I was on the overt side. And wrote an analysis of... I was in the area that dealt with the Soviet Union. And we were trying to... We were just starting up the economic research in the Soviet Union. So everything was at a very primitive stage. So it was interesting in that sense. And we did discover some things that turned out to be quite significant. We discovered that the Russians were producing guided missiles. The guy who was Secretary of Defense at the time, Wilson, who had been President of General Motors, didn't believe that, you know. He didn't believe it. He said, I was over in Russia during the war, and those guys couldn't put nuts on bolts, you know.
Yeah, that's
you can't tell me that they're going to put a man in space or anything like that. Well, so it, the CIA was vindicated when Russians sent up Sputnik, which caused great consternation and surprise in the rest of the government.
So where did you go to work after you got your degree?
55? Well, these are two jobs I had before I got the dissertation written.
Right.
And then I became, I was only in the CIA a year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
I became a research director for the Investment Bankers Association, which was in Washington. And I learned about the underwriting business, and that was very interesting. But then I, in 1961, in 1960, I was asked to become assistant to the Secretary of the Treasury in charge of debt management. This was in the Kennedy administration.
Mm-hmm. Dewey Dane told me a story. He said that you told him early in 1960 that there was going to be a recession and that he arranged a session between you and some Treasury economists, and you did your presentation. Apparently the Treasury...
The Secretary of the Treasury, Robert Anderson, was there, Secretary of the Treasury, and Charles Walker, you know, who had been with the Dallas Fed and was then Assistant Secretary of the Treasury, I think.
Yes. Do you know, is he still around? Is he still alive, Walker?
Yeah, he's a lobbyist. He's a big name lobbyist in Washington.
Right, I just hadn't seen the name for a while.
Yeah.
Okay, can you tell me that story, how they respond? When was this in the spring of 60? When would this
It was in the spring. It wasn't in May of 1960.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd been in, I was on a panel at the American Statistical Association in New York. They had mm-hmm. their annual meeting, and they have one of these forecasting sessions, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently somebody from the New York Times was there, and so I was forecasting recession, and nobody else was doing that, so I guess that was newsworthy. So I got a story in the New York Times, and when I got back to Washington, my boss was all upset because the Secretary of the Treasury called him up and said, "What is your man talking? This is an election year. Your man's talking about a recession." He was very upset, but Dewey and Charles Walker arranged to have me come over and have lunch with the Secretary and explain to him why I thought we were going into a recession. And, of course, by the National Bureau dating, the peak was dated at April.
Mm-hmm.
So we were already 1 month into the recession at the time. But I couldn't convince any of the... He had all of their economic guys around there, around the lunch table, and I couldn't convince anybody that there was any risk of going into a recession, much less being in one.
You were following leading indicators, the kind of thing that you see in the newspapers all the time today, or you just had a sense of how the economy was doing?
No, I've been following the indicator system for mm-hmm. beginning early in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote a few pieces for the National Bureau.
Mm-hmm. Arthur Burns was predicting a recession too then? I guess at least that's the famous story about how he told Nixon there was going to be a recession.
He could be. I don't know. I mm-hmm. never heard of him forecasting one, but it could well mm-hmm. be. They did.
Mm-hmm. So was it on that basis that you got the job at the Treasury?
Oh, I don't really think so. It was a change of administration, for one thing, from Republicans mm-hmm. to Democrats. But Dewey Dane was very, very instrumental. Dewey and I had been friends for some time. I think it was primarily the fact that I was a friend of Dewey's, because he was in the job that I later got, that is in charge of debt management.
Oh, he was already at the Treasury at that point.
Yeah, he had been at the Treasury on leave from the Minneapolis Fed.
Okay, I thought he came in with Kennedy.
No, he was in the Eisenhower administration.
Hmm.
And Douglas Dillon came in, and Bob Solow, not Bob Solow, but Bob Rosa,
yes,
was the undersecretary on the financial side of things.
Right.
And so Rosa wanted Dewey to stay on as his assistant for international business.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to be the domestic guy.
Hmm.
So Rosa had two assistants, one international, one domestic. And that was a wonderful job for me. It was...
didn't Peter Sternlight go to the Treasury about that time?
Peter went there afterwards, but at that time, we had a lot of very bright people there. Paul Volcker was there. He was starting up a research unit at the Treasury.
Do you have any Paul Volcker stories, any recollections of him?
Well, he immediately, I'd never met him until I got in the Treasury, but he immediately impressed everybody by how bright he was, you know.
Yes.
And Dillon was a very wealthy man. He used to buy up all of these, he'd buy up several tables at all of these, what used to be $100 plate dinners. I don't know what they are now, but
well.
But he didn't like to go to them, but he would support.
Yeah.
The thing, so he would buy up tickets and give them to his assistants, you know. So
mm-hmm.
Very often we would go out with the Volkers to one of these fancy fairs on Douglas Dillon's money. We had a wonderful time. And Barbara, Paul's wife, Barbara,
mm-hmm.
loves the whole Washington scene.
Hmm.
She really loved it. My wife was not so enamored with it. She didn't. She thought a lot of these Washington social affairs were rather stuffy and with an awful lot of people in it there that you didn't particularly care
sure.
for. You know.
What about Paul Volcker's attitude? Did he?
Volcker didn't like. He has never liked that. He's really a very introverted guy, you know. Big parties are never his. He'd like much rather be out fishing than going to a big party. But his wife loved it, you know. But she had diabetes at the time. It wasn't a handicap to her. But later on, it's a terrible degenerative thing, and
right.
In her case, it turned into severe arthritis.
Right. Yeah, I know that.
And so, when he became chairman, she stayed in New York, and he went back to New York on weekends.
Mm-hmm.
But if she'd been able to get around, she would have been dragging him to all those embassy parties, and he would have been miserable, you know. But she loved it. It was just one of those, you know.
Yeah. Did you have any contact with other economists? What about Kennedy's advisor, Seymour Harris? Was he at all?
I don't think of Seymour Harris as being a Kennedy advisor.
I think he was an advisor of Kennedy during the campaign, and then he went to Treasury for a while. Initially, but I think his intellectual affinity was with the council.
I had a lot of contact with the council, particularly Jim Tobin, who never thought the Jim thought we shouldn't sell any long term bonds, you know? And
mm-hmm.
Every time we sold one, he'd write a letter, a nasty letter to the president, you know.
And then you'd have a meeting of the Quadriad, and Martin would be under pressure to buy more long-term bonds. And
well, that came up when we had this period of
Operation Twist.
Operation Twist, yeah.
From the point of view of the Fed, that was a good thing. It took pressure off the Fed to keep short-term rates low.
Actually, we were pushing short-term rates up. The Treasury is supposed to do everything it could to push short-term rates up, and then the Fed was supposed to bring long-term rates down by buying in the open market, buying long-term
mm-hmm.
instruments. Yeah, the reason for pushing short-term rates up was because of our balance payments problem.
Mm-hmm.
Our short-term rates were not very competitive with European rates.
That's right.
And we had an outflow of capital, and we were trying to to deal with that in part by Operation Twist.
Yeah, I guess our rates were somewhat below 3%, and rates in Europe were around 5%.
Yeah.
But the council really believed that you could work on the term structure in that way. So,
Heller did too. In fact, I was on a panel. It was held at Fairfield University, but I forget who the sponsor was. Anyway, I was on a panel with Walter Heller, and this was not more than 10 years ago, and he was still advocating Operation Twist. And I told him, I was involved in the twisting on that thing, and it just didn't work, I told him what we would do is to create a temporary disequilibrium in the short-term money market by selling short-term, having this Treasury sell short-term securities in forms that the market didn't want.
Yeah.
For example, we would sell strips.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of, as today, where you bid for 30, 60, and 90-day bills, or you bid for a 90-day, 6 month and 1 year bills. We have them bid for, 13-week bills, 14-week bills, 15-week bills, and you had to buy a package.
Mm-hmm.
And the investors were not acclimated to buying bills on that basis.
Mm-hmm.
And so we would create a temporary disequilibrium, and, Treasury bill rates would go up by about 10 basis points and so on. In the long-term market, we did a study of, internal study of what happened in regulation under Operation Twist. And what we found is that we had a temporary influence occasionally on short-term rates, and we did tend to reduce the spread between Treasury bonds and corporate bonds. But we didn't have any impact on corporate bond yields or mortgage rates, which is what Tobin wanted.
What was Rose's attitude? I mean, this was his idea. Was he as enthusiastic as the council about influencing the term structure, or did he view it
more? No, I don't think he was. The one thing I should alert you to early on in this is that memory is a very difficult, it's a hazardous thing.
Well, I'm trying to talk to a number of different people, so that's the reason, to get more than one recollection.
But my recollection is that Rosa was not enthusiastic about it.
Mm-hmm.
So it was something we had to do,
Yeah, his concern was more with balance of payments and keeping short-term rates high
rate
enough.
Short-term
rates up, yeah. And
he didn't think that we could really do much to influence the term structure by purchasing long-dated instruments.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure of that.
How long did you remain with the Treasury?
Pardon?
How long did you remain with the Treasury?
I was there about 2 years.
Mm-hmm. And so you were there through 63?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then what did you do?
Then I came to Boston. I decided I never made any money, and I decided that I was reaching the age where, I was collecting kids, and I really should do something to get in a position where I might be able to make some money. So I went with an investment management house, Loomis Sales and Company, that happened to work out very well. I was there for 5 years. Just a few months before I went into the Fed. I went into the Fed in August of August 68.
Mm-hmm.
And Loomis Sales was sold to the New England Life Insurance Company in May 68. And I was one of the partners. Junior partner, but still a partner.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had the great experience of buying at book and selling at market, which was really very, it's first capital I really ever accumulated in my life, and it was a great experience.
So, but during that five-year period, you weren't involved in macroeconomics the way you were.
I wasn't. I was the economist for the firm, and I was later became head of the institutional department, which managed corporate pension funds and college endowment funds.
So, was it a relatively straightforward transition for you then to?
It was pretty easy because I'd been in the Treasury, were concerned about the economy, concerned about interest rates, Federal Reserve policy, and so when I came to Loomis Sayles, I always had to be concerned about the very same things. It was a very easy transition.
And I suppose there was a search committee from the directors at the Boston Fed, and you were on, you were on their list and interviewed, and
I was. It was kind of interesting. The I got a call from Howard Johnson, who was then president of MIT, and he invited me to have lunch with him at the president's house on Memorial Drive, and right on the Charles River. He didn't tell me what he wanted to talk to me about. I hadn't known him that well. I'd met him a few times, but turned out he was chairman of the board of the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston, and he wanted to know whether I'd be interested in becoming president of the Reserve Bank. And this came to me at a very awkward time because I just planned to leave Loomis Sayles to go with the Putnam Company. Putnam, at that time, was strictly a mutual fund company, and they wanted to broaden out and become managers of institutional funds. And so they offered me a really wonderful financial deal if I would go with them and start up their pension fund, college endowment fund business. And they told me they were going to sell the company within 5 years. So I go through another one of those things, buying a book and selling it market, which I thought was would have been a wonderful thing to do again.
Sure.
But, so I paced back and forth for a few days trying to figure out whether I really wanted to make money or whether I wanted to be a Federal Reserve Bank president. And I finally decided that I wanted to be a Federal Reserve Bank president.
Good.
I'd never
You'd done the other. Yeah. So when was the first FOMC meeting you went to? Would it have been in 68?
It was either August or September 68.
Well, that was a very interesting time that you came in. The FOMC was, at least after the fact, monetary policy had been very expansionary from about the middle of 67 through the end of 68. Do you have any perception at the time of how the FOMC viewed its monetary policy in terms of whether most members thought of it as being expansionary or not, and what kind of complications were raised by the passage of the tax cut in, I guess it was June of 68, or the tax surcharge?
Well, there were two elements in this situation that I think led to the Fed acting the way it did. One was that the conventional wisdom was that the tax increase, the 10% surcharge, if I'm correctly.
That's right.
On the income tax, was going to have the effect of slowing down the economy. And I mean, that was this is the one time where the FOMC got extremely bad forecasts from the staff. The staff bought the
council's forecast.
The general, you know, the conventional wisdom, hook, line, and sinker. And when the evidence started coming in that the economy wasn't slowing down, the staff did nothing to alert the FOMC to it. They were so wrapped up in the conventional wisdom. And I thought, you know, coming in on the FOMC for the first time, I thought I was a little reserved about dissenting as soon as I got on board.
Sure.
But I was, since I was a follower of the indicators, the leading indicators were very strong. They were showing no sign of the economy weakening. Quite the contrary, they were suggesting the economy was strengthening, despite the tax increase.
The board's chief economist, Dan Brill, he was pretty much straight Keynesian. I've never heard his economics described, but I just assumed he was Keynesian.
He's a bright guy, but again, here's a case where he... and Lyle Gramley was there, and he, if you talk to Lyle, I'll tell you, the whole bunch of them just fell asleep in this thing. But at the October meeting, I argued that the economy was not slowing down; it was really accelerating. But I didn't dissent, but I made that argument. Then in November, there were five dissents. There were four dissents in favor of tighter monetary policy. Myself and three other bank presidents.
Yes.
So four out of five bank presidents voted for a tighter policy in November. None of the board did.
Well, presumably Martin was under some kind of duress at that point.
I think so. I don't know for sure, but that's what I think happened.
He had lobbied heavily for the tax surcharge.
I think he made a commitment to Lyndon Johnson that if he got this tax increase through, interest rates wouldn't come down.
Yeah.
And I think because he was so astute, had this tremendously good judgment on policy, I just can't believe he didn't pick up what was going on. But I think he was just trapped into this commitment to Johnson.
Of course, he did believe that deficits caused inflation.
Oh, yeah.
So from his perspective, getting the deficit down was the most important thing. And then I believe the Fed was really stung in '66 when it pushed rates up, and housing housing starts fell so dramatically, and Congress suddenly became very aware of the Federal Reserve System. So I think Martin just felt that, well, the way to go was restrictive fiscal policy and, let that carry the...
I think that, all of the people of Keynesian persuasion, myself and Gardner Ackley and Tobin and... the whole lot, we're arguing from, it's 1965 on for a tighter fiscal policy.
Mm-hmm.
You had to finance the war properly or it was going to be inflationary.
Sure.
So this is a pretty broadly held. Obviously, the whole Keynesian school believed in this.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I think they were right. But they couldn't get the... the president thought he couldn't get his Great Society program through if he talked about raising taxes to finance the war. And
sure,
nothing happened. Finally, in 1968, he agreed to do it.
Right.
I don't know. I can't say that I know that Martin thought this way, but that's the only way I can reconcile what happened to what, is usually astute... sense for what policy ought to be doing. If you look over his whole record as chairman, That's a pretty damn good record.
Yeah, well, at this time he had the combination of Lyndon Johnson and Wright Patman that he was working with, the two Texan populists.
Yeah.
And anyways.
Dan Brill, I was having a drink with him once. He had gone with Commercial Credit.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know that.
Yeah. And I met him somewhere, and he's a really good guy. I liked him. And he was an able economist, he told me, we just fell asleep at the switch and this thing. And he said, George Mitchell came up to me. George is a member of the board.
Mm-hmm.
And, what he said to me? He said, how come the four of the five bank presidents knew what was going on in the economy and we didn't? So Brill thought he was sort of persona non grata around there, and he left the board and went with CIT.
Oh, as a consequence of the misforecasts
in
that period. Although I've looked at the Art Okun's forecast from the Council of Economic Advisors, and they really thought there was going to be a recession, and so they were obviously putting the heat on the Fed. To the point where they had suggested legislation to Johnson to take the regional reserve bank presidents off the FOMC. Anyways.
It was just one of the things. But as I say...
But the governors themselves, weren't they at that time fairly oriented toward... Keynesian policies of lowering unemployment, Maisel and Bremer, weren't they fairly kind of strongly oriented toward, unemployment objectives?
Well, Maisel was. I would say Bremer was less so than Maisel, is my recollection of him. But at the same time, if they had really... understood how strong the economy was, they would have voted for a different policy.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a misassessment of what was going on. And they felt they were so strongly that their forecast is right that they sort of discounted the data coming in, temporary aberrations, and that's not going to persist.
Yes, that's a good point.
We're talking about a short period here.
Because, but when things turn around, the data is always mixed initially, so you can look at it and see what you see.
No,
the
tax increase went into effect in July, and we had a unanimous vote for a tighter policy 5 months later. I mean, that's not an incredibly long period.
No.
But if you have a strong theoretical doctrine, for example, if you're a monetarist and you see the money supply growing gangbusters and the data in the economy comes on very weak,
mm-hmm.
you tend to say, well, the data...
It lags in the
wrong, but,
policy process.
Obviously, you can't mean a recession because we can't have a recession with all this money.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that we had the same kind of situation there.
So policy became restrictive in early 69, and that was pretty much a consensus policy among the FOMC because the inflation was rising and the economy was...
By that time, the
unemployment...
The concept that the economy was going to slow in its growth, obviously that doctrine was no longer in force, and people were acting on the basis of the data they were looking at, which is pretty strong.
Yeah, and unemployment got down to 3.3% that year, which seems pretty amazing now. Bill Martin began to back off from the restrictive policy later in that year, about the summer. Do you remember that? He's given some accounts, and he says he he himself began to back off from it before the full FOMC did. Does that ring a bell at all?
I don't know. He may have. I don't have a recollection of that, no. Mm-hmm. But so that's one thing you can, you know, we do have
the minutes.
The minutes for this.
Sure.
That period that'll give you the answer. But I don't have any.
Yeah. Of course, he tends to give a consensus view, so it's not always just in the minutes. It's not always exactly what he was thinking. Apparently, during the coffee break, he would meet with Al Hayes and Governor Robertson, and you know, come up with what they thought the consensus was going to be. So the statements in the minutes don't necessarily give you kind of a direct insight into what he was thinking. Things changed, of course, in February 1970 when Burns, Arthur Burns, became chairman.
You can say that again.
Do you remember the February 1970 meeting? Maisel writes it up in his book, and he says it was the most acrimonious FOMC meeting he ever attended. Basically, his account is that Hayes on one side felt that the Fed shouldn't lower rates until inflation actually began to come down, and Burns thought that that would send the economy into a really severe recession, maybe a depression, and, you know, did you remember any of that?
Well, there was acrimony between Hayes and Burns throughout the whole time they were both on the committee. You know, they never did see eye to eye, but that was, we didn't have that kind of overt acrimony during the Martin years. You know, Martin was a really amazing guy. I mean, he was just one of these natural-born leaders, you know, who knew precisely what course ought to be taken, and somehow managed to get the rest of the group around his point of view, or at least if he couldn't get it all the way, got it most of the way. But he did so in a very, I was once asked to give a war stories talk to the retired officers of the New York Fed. They have a dinner once a year, and Jerry Corrigan asked me to give a war stories talk.
Oh, yeah, well, if you can remember any of them, that's exactly what I'd like to get on.
And I was talking about some of the chairman. I said that Bill Martin ruled with pure charm. And that, I think, is a good description of it, because everybody loved the guy, you know? And you were willing to just go out of your way to accommodate him as you could, you know? And he was, very deferential to everybody, even the most junior people there, and very deferential to the staff too. I mean, and everybody felt he was an important part of the Federal Reserve when Martin was there. He made them feel that way.
Burns came into FOMC meetings, at least this is what Bob Black and Jim Parthemis said, giving you the impression he'd already made up his mind about what the FOMC should do.
Oh, yeah. I told the New York Fed people at that night at the dinner, I said, Martin ruled with pure charm.
Mm-hmm.
And then I said, Burns did not rule with charm, and they broke up the audience. You know?
Yeah. How did he interact with Al Hayes? I mean, Hayes had been there since, I guess, 56, 57.
Yeah. I don't really know whether there's any prior history of difficulties between the two, but they just seemed to to be antagonistic to each other right at the outset, you know, and it never really changed.
I mean, when Burns wanted to exert his authority, would he lecture? Would he? I mean, he obviously knew a lot about the business cycle. He'd studied a lot about the economy. Would he lecture, in a professorial way about the character of the business cycle? Was that the way he dealt with different points of view that he wanted
not
to
not really lecture, no. It was really sort of putting down any other point of view except his. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So he could be personally, I guess, antagonistic or hostile as the during a meeting.
He didn't like dissent. I'll tell you one of my war stories. At the the fall of 77, I think it was September or October, I thought monetary policy was too expansionary. And so I dissented. The only other guy in the committee who dissented with me was brand new president of the St. Louis Fed.
Yeah, Larry Roos.
Larry Roos, yeah.
In fact, you dissented in September and October in 1977, and then Roos...
When I went into the meeting in October, Burns' secretary said that he would like to see me before the meeting. And so I went in to see him, and his message was that he didn't think people should dissent unless they had a fundamental difference with the majority view. And I told him I agree with that, but that I had a fundamental difference a month before, and that's why I dissented. I didn't think it was dissenting in any trivial a difference. And so anyway, I went to the meeting, and when it came time to vote, I dissented again for the same reason, or same situation.
Wow.
And but Larry Roos did not dissent. And I thought, my God, you know, old Arthur had gotten to Larry Roos and gave him this lecture, and he could be a very intimidating guy, you know.
Yeah, I interviewed Daryl Francis, and Francis said that Burns even called him Sunday morning. I won't use the language Francis used, because it's kind of earthy language, but he said Burns even called him Sunday morning and chewed him out. Apparently Francis felt like he could put up with it.
Yeah. Burns was also difficult to get along with in administrative affairs too. You know, he only needed to sleep 4 hours a night.
Yes, I've read that.
And he didn't like to delegate anything to anybody else. That's fundamentally, you know, he didn't. I don't think he really thought that we ought to have an F1C. He thought he ought to be there. He shouldn't have to go running around trying to get all these guys to vote with him, you know. But he also got involved in administrative affairs. And I was then building a new building for the Boston Fed, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And Richmond was building their building at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And Bob Black and I, were continually getting pummeled by Arthur Burns in one way or another connected with the building, you know.
Yes, and Governor Sheehan was the other name that was mentioned as a headache.
Just give you one example of, they had approved the budget for the building. Then we went into competitive bidding on the building, and the lowest bid came in $7 million under the budget they'd approved. So, and the budget they had approved had a 5% contingency allowance. You know, it's a standard for major buildings. So I resubmitted a revised budget, $7 million lower. When the board sent back, this is typical Burns horseshit, you know. When I got the new budget back, they had cut it by more than $7 million because they cut the contingency allowance from 5% to 2%. And I was furious. Here I'd come in with a reduction in the budget of $7 million, a not inconsiderable sum, and they did that to me. They shafted me with that.
Well,
as a consequence.
Yeah, they did the same thing to us. They simply cut the request by 10%, so now most people park, you know, anyways. Yeah.
It was really infuriating business. And Paul Volcker was then in the earlier stages of planning a building for the New York Fed.
Yes, that's a whole nother story, too.
And so one time after the FOMC meeting, Burns said to us, and, you know, some of your presidents are building new buildings. I hear that talk around that you're happy about the way about my involvement in the building, and why don't we get together for lunch and talk about this thing, and, you know, it's very gracious, supposedly gracious way. So we got the building. I got the lunch, and Volcker said, well, Mr. Chairman, I don't see how you, as chairman of the Federal Reserve Board and chairman of the FOMC, can spend as much time as you've done on the characteristics of the flagpole for apparently Burke had been going back and forth with Burns on the nature of the flagpole. But he just got, you know, involved in every little frickin' detail and just
Did you become involved, have to become involved when Burns became chairman of the Committee on Interest and Dividends in terms of contacting firms about and banks about price and their pricing policies? And
no, I didn't do anything like that.
Okay. Some banks didn't. I know our bank had to become.
I didn't believe that made any goddamn sense, and I wasn't going to put my personal reputation at stake in trying to strong-arm bankers on something like that. I didn't say a word to anybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know our president resented that. The other thing that was particularly resented here was Burns' recruitment of the directors to lobby Congress over the Patman GAO audit bill. We thought that was inappropriate. I guess different banks felt differently about it. I don't know if that would have been in 73, I guess. I don't know if you got involved in that.
What was this for Patman? GAO audit?
Well, Wright Patman had a bill that would have required a GAO audit of the Fed, including the monetary function as well as the... And there was no GAO audit at that time, at least not since 1935. And Burns asked the presidents of the regional Federal Reserve banks to ask their directors to inform Congress that they didn't think this was a good idea. Subsequently, Congressman from Wisconsin,
Brockmeyer,
the other one, one from Milwaukee, anyways, he held hearing, found out about it, and held hearings on it.
You're probably thinking of Henry Royce.
Yeah, Royce. Apparently you didn't, your directors didn't get involved in that.
I don't recall
lobbying effort.
Getting involved in that. No.
Mm-hmm. monetary policy then became moderately expansionary in early 70 when Burns became chairman. It became more expansionary toward the end of 70. Maisel writes in his book that twice the governors lowered the discount rate right before FOMC meetings, and Maisel says as a way of sending a message to the full FOMC that the board wanted lower interest rates. And then, you know, in 72, we can talk about that in a minute, but monetary policy did move to some degree, at least, with shifts in thinking at the White House. I mean, at the time, what did you think about Burns's relationship with the White House? Did you have any feelings about the relationship he maintained with people at the White House, or at the time it wasn't something that occurred to you?
I didn't worry about it too much, but I thought, you know, that kind of continuing contact with the White House is simply not appropriate for a Fed chairman. It cannot lead to any good result.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember early 1972, the FOMC began an experiment with reserves control, which was pretty much aborted from the beginning because Burns established bounds on the movement in the federal funds rate.
Remember that. Yeah, it just never got off the ground.
And apparently Andy Brimmer in particular was disturbed by the unwillingness of Burns to allow the funds rate to move. Do you have any recollections from 1972 in terms of Burns's relationship with the full committee, and was he challenged at all? For example, in spring of 1972, when the dollar came under attack, Hayes from New York was critical. Do you have any other recollections from that year?
Well, I remember. I think one of the most destructive things he did was to put on a campaign for wage and price control.
Yeah, that began.
And you know, that is really, for the head of a central bank to get involved in something like that is really bad. And furthermore, to the extent he's successful in doing that, it means you're losing a lot of information about the effect of monetary policy and the economy.
That's a good point. I hadn't heard that, but that's absolutely right.
No question that that happened. Yeah. I think that if to the extent that you suppress inflation, people tend to forget about it and follow more expansionary policies than they otherwise would.
Well, Burns really believed in the wage and price controls. Apparently, at least I read parts of Sapphire's book, and he describes a meeting at the very end of 1972 between Burns and Herb Stein, and they're trying to set guidelines for price increases in 1973, and Burns is arguing very strongly for a 2% guideline. Of course, things just blew off in 73, but he must have really believed that this would deal with price pressures, and then monetary policy could, you know, bring unemployment down to 4%.
Yeah. Well, it was just terrible advice to give the president. Mm-hmm. And, of course, from my background in price control, I left there, as I think most people did. Most economists left the Office of Price Stabilization. Galbraith is the only one I know who felt differently, that, you know, the market is a wonderful thing, and mm-hmm. and to screw it up with price controls is just not going to work unless you have extremely unusual conditions such as World War II.
Mm-hmm.
But, Oh, well, I should run now. Can we pick this up again?
Burns anticipated the depth of the recession that would follow the restrictive policy he pushed, especially in the last half of 74. And do you think that he thought the recession was primarily due to Fed actions, or do you think he thought it was due to the rise in the price of oil?
No, I think we all anticipated that we would generate recession with the policy.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the inevitable cost
mm-hmm.
to prevent the increase in the price of oil, which is the primary inflation force, from spreading into the rate of increasing wages and so on.
So there was a lot of concern that the rise in prices produced by the oil price would spread generally through the economy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think most of us felt that some of this was inevitable. I mean, oil is such a basic commodity.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's reflected in, you know, most of the prices of commodities.
Mm-hmm.
Manufactured goods, it'd be hard to find one that for which the price of oil was irrelevant. And I think, in retrospect, the mistake in 73-74 is not that we generated a recession. The mistake that was that we didn't we came out of the recession too fast. I think what happened is that inflationary expectations were building up.
Yes.
They've been building up before the oil price shock, but that really reinforced them tremendously. And we really needed to, and I say that's all in hindsight, where
sure.
Nobody makes a mistake in hindsight.
Sure.
But we needed to deal with the inflationary expectations, and we didn't do that. The recession was too short. Came out of it with inflationary expectations essentially intact.
Yeah, I think that's right. Inflation itself came down quite dramatically in 76, I guess it was. But then monetary policy became, well, if not expansionary, at least certainly stopped being restrictive in 77. How would you assess the governors in 77 in terms of their willingness to pursue restrictive policy as opposed to a policy aimed at unemployment? Some of them, like Charles Partee, were pretty much interested, very much concerned about real things, weren't they? Wasn't there a lot of talk about the danger of aborting the recovery and...
Partee was always on the... I can't recall when Partee ever led a discussion in favor of higher interest rates.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I did a little study once at the Spence. It hasn't been published, but I gave a lecture on it.
Mm-hmm.
And what I did find is quite a pattern of in the sense of the policymakers. I found that you'd expect that the average policymaker would have some dissents for tighter policy and some dissents for a easier policy.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, that isn't the way it worked out. I was one of the few who were on both sides. And in fact, I had two dissents in 77 for a tighter policy.
Mm-hmm.
But most people either had all their dissents on the expansionary side or all their dissents on the restrictive side. And Pete was one of those who had all of his dissents in it. the restrictive side. This was for the period, I think, in 1960 through 1990, but it's a long period.
Right.
And so, you, of course, the monitors in the group were almost all, they didn't have any, I don't recall that they had any dissents on the expansionary side. But we had people like R.T. and quite a few others who had all their dissents on the expansionary side, in favor of more expansionary policy.
Well, I think we've done that too, and we also found there really is quite a difference between presidents and governors. If you omit Wallach in the 1980s, presidents are much more likely to dissent in favor of a more restrictive policy than governors.
Yeah. And that was my conclusion, too. And in fact, Henry Wallach had, take out Henry Wallach, the governors in general had very few dissents to be more restrictive.
Mm-hmm.
Very few.
There were a few. Brimmer dissented in 72 in favor of more restrictive
mm-hmm.
policy. He was obviously on the outs with Burns. And I think a few times, Coldwell.
Coldwell. Yeah, he tends to be rather very conservative.
Because he'd been a bank president.
That's right.
What about these governors? The names don't mean too much to me anymore. Steve Gardner, Philip Jackson, Monroe Kimbrell, David Lilly.
Kimbrell was very conservative on policy. The others, Lilly, who were the others you mentioned?
Jackson, Gardner.
I don't really have any particular image of them. When I look back at it, I can think of a few guys who were always very conservative on policy and a few who were very expansionary.
Mm-hmm.
But most of them were in between, you know.
Yeah.
As is just a normal curve.
Sure.
I'd have to look up. My recollections, I don't recall those guys dissenting from the majority in any significant way.
What about 77, Burns's last year? Do you feel like he was constrained by the fact that he was up for reappointment at the end of the year?
I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think Arthur was ever really constrained by anything or anybody. You know, he had his own beacon, and he mm-hmm. followed it pretty restrictively. I don't, for example, believe that Arthur was as political a chairman as most people think.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he was dominated by the White House at all.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, you know, knowing him, I'm sure he thought his judgment was much better than anybody in the White House. Thought his judgment was much better than anybody, period.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that his judgment was not very good on monetary policy. And this is true of a lot of distinguished scholars. I was on a program with Jerry Jordan recently. Maybe I told you this, but this is at the Western Economic Association meetings.
Mm-hmm.
A year ago, June it was, and he and I were on a panel on monetary targeting.
Mm-hmm.
And what the hell was I leading up to?
On the ability of on the ability of chairmen to make good judgments.
The
correct monetary policy.
And we agreed that most eminent scholars tend to have very bad judgment on policy.
Mm-hmm.
I name, for example, Jim Tobin. Jim Tobin, I can't recall a time ever when Tobin was for a more restrictive policy.
Yes, we used to read the Red Book, and he always thought if he lowered the funds rate, he'd tell you how much the bond rate would come down, and
yeah,
that would be a good thing. That was a regular...
Jordan said, you know, the same thing is true of Milton Friedman. Friedman's judgment of policy is terrible.
Mm-hmm. Well, Friedman thought in 1970, for example, that the Fed should pursue a gradualist policy, and, you know, Burns pushed the Fed away from that. And in fact, it turned out that if the Fed had, you know, been sharply restrictive in early 77, brought the inflation rate down, it would have, but you know, the political system didn't have the patience to stick with the anti-inflationary program for 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, it turned out not to be a good, correct judgment about what was feasible for policy.
Also, I think that if you're dealing with inflationary expectations,
mm-hmm.
you know, a small reduction in the rate of growth of money supply is not going to have any effect on that.
Mm-hmm.
You need interest rates so high
mm-hmm.
that they really, the money becomes, in real terms, becomes too expensive to go ahead with anything.
Mm-hmm.
And to get interest rates that high, would have pretty severely restrictive effects on the rate of growth of the money supply.
Oh, sure. Well, summer 1981.
But, I mean, if we tried to put in gradualism in 80, you know, in 79,
mm-hmm.
let's say we tried to gradually work the money supply down.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how long it would take us to get the inflation rate down, but it would have taken one hell of a long time because gradualism in a situation like that, where you have strongly entrenched inflationary expectations, just won't work.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to nudge people by small changes in policy in that context.
Mm-hmm. Well, Burns, for all his knowledge of the business cycle, really wasn't a financial or a monetary economist. His thing was the real side in leading indicators, and he thought, he was very good at predicting short-term movements, and for a lot of purposes, that's very important. But for the strategic purpose of controlling inflation, it didn't. You know, that skill didn't serve him very well.
And he was essentially very timid when it came to making policy. I mean, he was a guy that had the combination of talking extremely tough on monetary policy,
mm-hmm.
but when it came to changing policy, he was very timid, and so I used to get really be amazed at the contrast between the public image of Burns as, you know, this fierce inflation fighter, and the actuality of Burns as a policymaker, and he was anything but a fierce inflation fighter.
Well, was that because, I mean, he would say things like, oh, we would, you know, a sharp change in interest rates would disturb financial markets and it would go to confidence. Do you think that was, you know, he was primarily concerned with financial markets, or do you think he was concerned that he really would, you know, affect unemployment, or do you think he was concerned about the politics of the situation? He was under a lot of pressure from a hostile Democratic Congress, and, you know, a White House that wanted 4% unemployment. Why the timidity?
I think it's just it's hard to understand. But I think it's just part of his character. I'll give you one example where, you know, we had one day a long discussion of intervening in the foreign exchange market. And the committee decided that, you know, the dollar was dropping like a rock.
Mm-hmm.
And the committee decided that we're going to have a major intervention program. And, you know, the way we're organized, we have this committee. The FOMC determines general policy, but the operation is determined by this committee.
Right.
Chaired by the chairman.
Right, yeah.
So I thought, really is going to intervene. I went around and found that he only dollar market, you know.
Yeah, and I'm sure he didn't raise the funds rate either, or the discount rate.
No, no. Oh,
that
no,
was probably 7.
But he didn't even want to intervene on any scale that would possibly make any difference.
That was probably 1973?
Can't remember that.
Okay.
Timing, but that's a good example of his thinking. You know, he talked, he was talking about intervening, and when it came to bite the bullet, Arthur could never bite the bullet. He could never bite the bullet.
Yeah, I remember one experience in, I think it was March 1977, and the staff sent down, right before an FOMC meeting, a memo on how we'd been missing our M1 target for over a year, and that wasn't acceptable. We were going to get inflation, and we went up to the FOMC meeting all excited, thinking, well, we're really going to raise the funds rate in this recovery. We're going to stay on top of inflation. And we got up there, and Burns said, well, I just got back from a meeting at the White House, and Carter's going to announce his energy program next week, and we don't want to disturb financial markets. They can only take so much bad news at one time, and nothing ever, you know, nothing was done.
That's typical. Yeah. That's typical. I just didn't have it in him. He just was, you know, constitutionally not well adjusted to be being a monetary policy maker.
But on with Burns, it seems almost inexplicable in the sense that he had no, he certainly individually was both a dominating and a domineering person. He did not care for dissent. He wanted to dominate any kind of environment he was in. You would think that would carry over to a sort of ruthlessness and willing
to.
So.
Yeah, this combination of the dominance and indecisiveness. And that's a rare combination, but that's exactly how I would describe Burns. Hmm. Dominant personality, but indecisive when it came to actually making a decision.
Hmm. Oh, well, it sounds like a psychological study. I'm not sure how far we can get on that, but you're absolutely right in that those observations. Well, let's go on to 78 and G. William Miller. He'd been on your board, right?
Yeah.
And was he the chairman or?
He was. He was chairman at the time he was appointed.
And you've always had a very distinguished board in Boston. People like Solo have been on it. In terms of a representation of intellectuals and successful business people, there's really, you know, not many boards like Boston's in the country. How did he, as a board chairman, how did he? How did he work?
Well, he was a big disappointment to me because, first of all, the guy is very bright.
Yes.
I thought he learned a lot about monetary policy in years on our board. I think that, he was a very political chairman. That was a disappointment to me. There's no question. He was, I think, more political in his orientation than any other chairman, including Burns, I think.
That, you think he felt like he owed something to the Carter people, or it was just, he felt like...
I really think he thought he was part of the administration. Mm-hmm. Now, he may argue with this with me. He's an awfully nice guy. I like him personally.
Mm-hmm.
But he certainly acted that way. And second, he's been head of a large corporation, Textron, for many years, and he was not used to working in a collegial fashion. He was used to saying, this is what we're going to do, and let's go do it, you know. And he was very frustrated in the board, you know. One of the first things he did, he was deaf on smoking.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing he did was try to get the FOM to ban smoking at FOMC meetings. And he was defeated. You know, at the time, Volker was smoking cigars, Henry Wallach smoked a pipe, I was smoking cigarettes, and we had quite a few smokers around there. And we didn't have a majority of smokers, but when it came to a change in the rule, he didn't get any support at all.
Yeah, I think I can remember. I think Bob Black and Jim Parthemis coming home saying that he'd put out the no smoking signs on the table, and he was sitting between Volker and Wallach, and you could hardly see him or the no smoking signs for all the pipe smoke, cigar smoke.
Tell the staff, get rid of all the ashtrays. You know?
Yeah, right. I'd forgotten that.
So the first thing that smokers did when they came the meeting, they had to scrounge around, find an ashtray, and bring it into the committee room. But he was very uncomfortable in an environment in which he had to develop a consensus in order to get anything done. It was not his style, you know.
Yes, I was here at that time, and the two things we remember was the way he limited the amount of time each speaker had. That was the first thing, and the second thing was that what he really wanted was kind of a prediction derby. He wanted you to come up with your numbers on what the economy was going to do, and then he kept track of them and kind of evaluated, apparently, how well you did. But he was really, what he wanted was, you know, the numbers you had, you know, for the economy. Wasn't really interested in discussions.
He was just not well suited to be chairman. I would say most heads of large non-financial corporations would probably be not much better. I mean, if you got Welch from General Electric, he'd been on the New York Fed Board.
Yeah.
Would he be a good chairman? I doubt it, you know.
Yeah.
You need someone with a good financial background to be a chairman. Otherwise, he's operating with a tremendous handicap. It's hard to make up that lack of background in a hurry. On the other hand, I think Miller, when he became Secretary of the Treasury, was a pretty good Secretary of the Treasury.
Mm-hmm.
He was very supportive of the Fed. He didn't try to ever put pressure on the Fed.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was very instrumental in appointing Volcker as chairman to succeed Burns, or to succeed himself, rather.
That's interesting. I know in the first half of 77, Volcker dissented a number of times. So, Volcker was not, at least at that point, being a passive member of the FOMC.
I'm sure he had a big input in the selection of Volcker, because here was a guy who had been chairman of the Fed and who was also Secretary of the Treasury, and certainly any president would be strongly inclined to take his advice, particularly when Wall Street was telling him that's who they wanted.
Miller remained a good friend, particularly of Walter Mondale, and and so that was just a personal friendship.
Miller had been very active in Democratic politics.
Mm-hmm.
In Rhode Island, he was, among the movers and shakers in Democratic politics in Rhode Island, and I'm sure he was involved in a lot of national Democratic things too. And so he knew the Democratic political people pretty well.
Mm-hmm. Our impression was he really didn't have a strategy for changing the funds rate other than doing it very cautiously and, kind of looking out the window and seeing if it was going to have any effects on the real economy?
Well, you know, actually, if you look back on that, period, you look back in 78, 79,
mm-hmm.
we really did move the federal funds rate a long way. I mean, it was federal funds rate had gotten up to 11%
mm-hmm.
by when Volcker took over.
Mm-hmm.
And an 11% funds rate, even though it was a negative real rate, was mm-hmm. in nominal terms extremely high. I mean, nobody had ever seen a rate that high.
Yeah.
So, and I think one of our problems in the 70s was one of the problems of the policymakers, and also a problem of the bond investors,
mm-hmm.
was this fixation on nominal rates. You know, we're all standing around saying, gee whiz, 11% funds rate. That's just enormous.
Mm-hmm.
And the bond investor, you look back and see what long-term bonds were selling at in those years. You know, we had for a very considerable period of time negative real returns on long-term government bonds.
Yeah.
So the bond investor was thinking very much like the policymakers. They were caught up in the high nominal
mm-hmm.
rates, thinking that had to be very restrictive, you know. And
sure.
we went on like that for a considerable period of time until, we finally began thinking in terms of real interest rates. That came very late.
Yeah.
But there wasn't much discussion real interest rates. In my recollection, at the FOMC table,
mm-hmm.
Until we finally started, thinking, this came rather belatedly. If interest rates are so high, how come the economy's so strong?
Mm-hmm.
And we finally decided, at that famous October 79 meeting.
Mm-hmm.
That right, we don't know what level of interest rates it's going to take to turn around inflationary expectations, but it's got to be extremely high, and high enough to cause all kinds of political turbulence if we stayed with a money target with an interest rate targeting thing. So we've got to go move to monetary targeting to give us a little political freedom for moving interest rates as fast as we think they're going to have to be moved.
Yeah, let's come back to that in just a second.
Yeah.
In the first half of 79, the board staff thought there was going to be a recession, and Miller signed on to that, so there was a split within the committee and also within the administration over how aggressive monetary policy ought to be. Does that ring a bell?
My recollection is kind of fuzzy on that. I don't. I don't have a strong image of what the thinking was about the. I don't really. I don't recall talking much about a possible recession. It may have happened, mm-hmm. but maybe somebody's model might have shown that. 11% funds rate is bound to cause a recession.
Well, the board staff was there. The Green Book predictions were for a recession, and some of the governors took it quite seriously. And Miller apparently too. But
I'd forgotten that. I didn't know the staff had that prediction. Well, that would help to explain it too,
mm-hmm.
because apparently the staff had the same nominal interest rate problem, and they're thinking that the policymakers did that.
Mm-hmm.
With interest rates this high, the economy's got to slow down.
Right. Miller didn't care so much as other Fed chairmen as consensus within the FOMC. I mean, he was willing, for example, to be outvoted on the discount rate, and it didn't occur to him that would weaken his position as Fed chairman or
Yeah, I told him that when he took the job, I said, you know, one thing you can't do as chairman, you always have to be on the majority side. Because once you are recorded as being in the minority, your influence and your image in the street is just going to go down the chute. And that's exactly what happened. When he was upvoted on a discount rate move, from that day forward, nobody on the street. Hold on, I've got somebody at the door.
Sure.
He never saved his position until everybody else had talked, you know?
Yeah.
So he knew where the consensus was. Sometimes he would make a few remarks to try to nudge the consensus in one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
And very often he carried out policy in a little different fashion than the majority wanted him to, because he had more control over policy, execution of policy, than any other chairman, because the directive was not quantified. You know, it was a very fuzzy directive.
That's right. It was in terms of free reserves,
and
nobody quite knew what that meant.
Really, Martin was essentially you know, within broad limits, do whatever he wanted to in terms of execution. And very often, not often, but occasionally, some member of the committee would start criticizing the manager for not following the directive. Because if it wasn't the manager's fault, it was Martin telling him that what he ought to be doing. You know?
Well, the manager and the direct, you know, Martin was on the phone with the manager. Yeah, I just looked over 1959. I was talking to Raymond Saulnier, and I went back and looked at that period. And for the last half of 59, the FOMC, you know, was just setting a given target for free reserves, and yet the market rates rose, you know, pretty sharply in August and again in December. And Saulnier thought that, well, you know, the Fed set its targets for free reserves and walked away from it, and policy wasn't tightening, and that had to have been all Martin, because I went back.
Oh, yeah,
I read through the FOMC minutes.
Only Martin could have gotten away with that.
Yeah.
Because he, as I say, he had this. Nobody wanted to. Everybody loved him. You know?
Yeah.
And everybody had high respect for his judgment, too, because it had been so good, you know. Until that's why I think in 68 he didn't have any choice but to go with the wrong policy. But his judgment was just amazingly good. The guy was, I could never figure out, he didn't like to talk about economic statistics. He,
mm-hmm.
he didn't want to talk about the money supply at all. He didn't.
Yeah.
And yet, his judge, he was the guy that didn't trust economic statistics, didn't think it was sensible to control the money supply short run, and yet he can, had, under him, we controlled the money supply better than under any other chairman. And, but it's just because, you know, policy was correct under him, and if you have correct policy, the money supply is going to perform pretty well.
Well, he had a real suspicion of inflation.
The
sense that it creeps up on you, and you have to stay on top of it. And that was very different than
Burns
exactly.
He would never have permitted the inflation. If he'd stayed on instead of Burns,
mm-hmm.
Policy in the '70s would have been a lot tighter under Martin. I don't have any doubt of that. We would have made a lot fewer mistakes. I asked him once, you know, he could not have been reappointed because the Federal Reserve Act permits a governor to serve only one full term. And he had served, he was chairman for 19 years,
mm-hmm.
but only because he served first as
filled out McCabe's term.
Fired term of 5 years.
Yeah.
I got another guy to go. Hold on, I'll be right back.
finishing up with Bill Martin. Of course, also you had Al Hayes at the New York Fed, and he carried a lot of weight, and he was very concerned about the international situation, the dollar, the balance of payments. So the combination of his international concerns and Martin's domestic concerns for inflation, dominant influences.
Very much concerned about inflation control as well as the international effects of it. Mm-hmm. He wasn't strictly towards the balance of payments.
Of course, Martin was careful too about changing policy abruptly, and as long as you had an environment of stable inflation, that could work. But once you let the cat out of the bag, and
he consistently moved to tighten policy before any increase in the inflation rate showed up.
Mm-hmm.
And he was running it properly. And even if you, I think it's interesting that, except apart from the 68 problem, which I think was, an exception to the rule, you go back over that whole period and try to second guess him, you really can't come up with much to complain about during his regime. I mean, that was a hell of a good period for monetary policy.
Let's talk about Volcker. How did Volcker bring along the doves on the board? People like Teeters and Rice and Partee. The move to the non-board reserves monetary control procedures, that was a unanimous vote. Did Volcker have to do quite a bit of juggling to bring everybody on board, do you think?
No, he didn't. Surprisingly, what happened is that, up to that point in time, as I say, we had been overly influenced by high nominal interest rates. I think at about that time, everybody on the committee came to the conclusion that, monetary policy has not been as restrictive as we thought, that we're obviously going to have to have much higher rates, and that we've got to have an operating procedure which gives us leeway to produce much higher rates. I think we all came to that conclusion at about the same time.
Yeah.
And that's why this was the most revolutionary meeting we had in the 20 years I was going to FOMC meetings.
Yeah, I think that's right.
No other meeting that compares with this one. Here we were not only making a major change in policy, making the biggest move in policy we'd ever made in one jump, but we were changing our operating procedures at the same time, and the majority of the committee was not monetarists in their thinking.
Sure.
So, given that, you'd have to say, how the hell do we get a majority? Much less a unanimous judgment. And I think it's just that the weight of the evidence had gotten so enormous on all of us that we had to change what we've been doing up to that point in time was a complete failure. And that we had to